Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's the 22nd of November 2016. Anna suggested the other day that we do a podcast entitled Nature 101, since we're always referring to him. It's actually not as easy as it sounds. Nietzsche's one of those philosophers who is wide open to interpretation and misinterpretation, I should add. Nietzsche was born in 1844 in October, and he died in 1900. The last 11 years of Nietzsche's life were unproductive. He collapsed in January 1889 in Turin at the sight of a coachman whipping his horse, and the horse had sort of stumbled down onto the floor. Nietzsche, the report goes, flung his arms around the horse and kissed it and wept. And that was pretty well the beginning of a descent into some kind of insanity. In 1888, the previous year, Nietzsche had been in what sounds like a manic state. And he wrote 5 books of a startling quality, I would say, in that one year. People who have their imagination captured by Nietzsche often get pulled up with this fact of Nietzsche's life, that he went mad for the last 11 years. And the implication is, well, if you're kind of going to entertain this stuff, be careful, because you'll end up like him. And Nietzsche certainly was a very, very bold thinker. He wasn't a systematic thinker. He didn't produce a massive, elaborate system like Hegel or Leibniz or Kant. And he even spoke in a few places about the folly of attempting to erect these edifices. Bertrand Russell said of Nietzsche that he was a merely a literary philosopher who had made no technical advance in the discipline, by which Russell means development in logic. That's what he means by technical philosophy. And Nietzsche, yes, certainly was of a literary bent. Of course, he wrote Also Sprach Zarathustra, which is a purely fictional, mythical account of a kind of post-death of God prophet in the one Zarathustra of the title. Some people think Zarathustra is in fact a novel. And it's a highly symbolic work, written in a sort of quasi-prophetic style. It's quite strange, really, when you think about it. Probably is a masterpiece. So given this anti-systematic approach of Nietzsche's, and given his literary bent, you can see that Nietzsche 101 isn't going to be that easy. I mean, the other thing about Nietzsche that makes it even more difficult to give some kind of summary is is the way in which his thought changes. And nature does go through recognisable periods and develops. His thought develops, of course. But nature kind of picks up certain themes and then drops them, and then they appear again, perhaps in a different guise, and then disappear again. And the big ideas, big Nietzschean ideas, the will to power, affirmation, the Dionysian, the eternal return of the same, the Übermensch or the Superman or the Overman, whatever you want to call it. These are themes which pop up, disappear, pop up, and also which change their emphasis, get put to different uses. And as I say, this does make it kind of fairly tricky. On top of this, you've got the fact that nature puts a lot of effort into a nihilistic attack on what you could call Platonism and Christianity, which he saw as Platonism for the masses. Now, Platonism, on nature's take, is the notion that there is a higher reality to which we should aspire to make contact with, and which vouchsafes our conclusions about things. It becomes like the backstop, the metaphysical backstop. And nature thought that this was now indefensible, that the developments of European thought had reached a point where, in fact, God is dead, or Platonism is empty. The guarantee of Platonism, the higher world, has become the higher swindle, as nature called it. And he spends quite a bit of time and energy deconstructing Platonism, deconstructing the higher world, deconstructing Christian theology with a kind of nihilism. But it is the nihilism which gives a shove to that which is already about to topple as well. Nietzsche's genealogical account of the gradual weakening of Platonism is one which he gives considerable attention to. So, Nietzsche 101, not easy. Where to start? In his last published work, aka Homo, Nietzsche's it's a very, very strange autobiography. Nietzsche states that he sees no way of undertaking a great task except through the means of play. We call it the ludic. I call it the ludic means. And there's a lot of crazy and throwaway remarks, apparently throwaway remarks anyway, in Ecce Homo. It's a very strange book. But when I spent a lot of time carving out some paths through the undergrowth of Nietzschean philosophy, I kind of lighted on that, and in a sense took it as a bit of a starting point. So what does he mean by a great task? Well, Nietzsche, again, in his manic inflation in this last part of his productive life, when he was hurtling towards madness, Nietzsche somewhat grandiosely stated that Christ had written the history of the last 2,000 years, and he, Nietzsche, was going to write the history of the next 2,000 years. And the great task actually is an overturning that Nietzsche aspires to by floating out some extremely potent memes into the body politic of the grip of Platonism, or of the higher swindle. And I called this, when I was researching this extensively, propositionalist philosophy. So nature saw his task, yeah, as a cultural warfare. And that explains why his treatise of 1886, on the genealogy of morals, why Nietzsche subtitled it a polemic. In other words, it's an act of war. You know, it's a treatise. It's war propaganda. It's from the Greek polemos, war, dispute, strife. So Nietzsche is wanting to revolutionise the culture. He's revolutionary. It's not like a material revolutionary like Marx. He thinks we change the way people think and the stories that they believe in. And that's partly a destructive process of undermining those stories, and partly a process of giving some positive ideas with which to work. So actually, what is wrong with Platonism, or the higher world, or ontotheology, if you want to call it that? What's the problem with it? Hasn't it served us quite well? Hasn't it helped us to build this technical civilization? Well, Nietzsche says there is it has done great things. But at the same time, when we place value, the highest value in the higher world, which Nietzsche seeks to point out is purely imaginary, purely an efflorescence of a certain way of thinking, then you also denigrate the lower world. Nietzsche called this life negation. And he seems to think that the attraction of Platonism, or of heaven, is the Christian empyrean. Comes out of an attitude of life negation. Well, why would we negate life? Well, because it's painful. Because we suffer. And because we suffer from change. And because we suffer from the complications that ensue out of our sexual appetites, and because we suffer from the complications that ensue out of our appetite for aggression. And because at more or less any time in the history of the world, a lot of people are enslaved to the economic order. And they suffer the frustration of not being able to exert will to power, not being able to make things happen, not being able to control their own lives. So you see, there's a whole complex of reasons for negating life, which he sees as productive of the fantasy, the compensatory fantasy, perhaps, of the higher world, the Platonic empyrean, the sun outside the cave, the sun of truth outside the cave. And Nietzsche wants to, as a part of his great task, institute a culture of life affirmation, which we say yes to life, this life. So he says that is his great task, and the means is play. And I think that idea that the means is play is very, very interesting. And you can see how it is the kind of antithesis of the plodding methodology of ontotheology or of Platonism or of the higher world. And how it's anti-systematic. You can see where the anti-systematic thrust of Nietzsche's work comes about, because he's espousing the methodology of play. Also, Nietzsche saw in the figure of the child, which he explicates in a fairly roundabout way in Zarathustra, in a passage entitled On the Three Metamorphoses. He says that the play is fundamentally life-affirming. So the ludic method is the life-affirmative method of doing philosophy. We entertain the imaginary, but we drop it with equal ease. See, the thing about Platonism, it demands this kind of fanatical allegiance to the higher, to the good, to the true, to God. It has to be fanatical, because that is the last trump in the pack. You know, the purpose of the transcendental signifier, whether it's God or the good or whatever, is to give us the security of certain answers to life's big questions. What happens when we die? What are we supposed to do? What is our duty? Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? And so on and so on and so on. And there needs to be a fanatical commitment to the touchstone which enables us to answer all those questions, to which we can refer all those questions. I mean, it's easiest to see in kind of monotheistic theology, but you can see the same mechanism in Vedanta and even in existentialism, you know, where the transcendental signifier is just emptiness or nothingness. Now, in play, you might actually imagine a transcendental signifier to find out where it leads. Experiment. Just as a child might imagine that a stick is a gun, or a dining room chair is the captain's chair on the Starship Enterprise. But where play would differ in this respect from Platonism is that there's no fanatical attachment to the concept. The concept is explored. It's seen, we see if it has any use. We look at where it leads. We look to see if anybody has followed that path. We look to see if that path has had a result in the world, in the popular understanding, or in the development of science or literature or whatever. But we can drop it with equal ease. That's the beauty of the ludic method, is it has that lightness touch of play, and it will be accompanied by laughter. I think also this notion that Nietzsche is using this ludic method of play explains how certain concepts get dropped. They just fall from view for a while, if you look at the work chronologically, and then they reappear, but perhaps in a slightly different guise. And we see that with the concepts of will to power and the eternal return, that they have different functions at different times. I allowed myself, when I was looking at these big concepts of Nietzsche's, to take the notion of play as philosophical method quite seriously, and to see how they looked in that light as itself a ludic engagement with the text. And with something like a big concept that appears in Nietzsche in most periods and in several guises, like the will to power, taking the Ludic methodology seriously, you do have to see the nature is sometimes engaging in parody. That there's sometimes an irony in the way he uses a concept. But then he'll just, given the sort of free nature of play, he'll let the will to power be a cosmological concept, an overarching cosmological concept. As he says in 1888, in his notes, which you can find in the volume called The Will to Power, and then she says something like, oh my brothers, the world is will to power, and nothing but will to power, and you yourselves are will to power, and nothing but will to power. You see this massive macrocosmic and microcosmic totalising concept. But what we have to take on board there is the way Nietzsche makes his utterance. His utterance is a rhapsodical utterance. Nietzsche is poeticising out of some rhapsodic or ecstatic state, or a Dionysian state, you might add. And that is his insight in the Dionysian state. And actually, that insight is Heraclitus's insight, you know, that everything flows, everything is movement. Because the cosmological will to power is like a kind of an idea that the universe is composed of points of will to power, which are in constant interaction, constant dancing interaction, attempting to overcome, attempting to absorb, sometimes forming alliances with other points of will to power, and so on. And that the whole manifestation of existence on the social level, on the cultural level, the physical level, the ontological level, and so on, is really all just this dance, this this movement of points of will which seek to overcome and to dominate, even though sometimes they will absorb other wills to power and ally with other wills to power and so on. But elsewhere, Nietzsche is more modest of the concept and sees it just as one of the chief human motivations, you know, that people exert power, I like to exert power. It's a turn on. And sometimes nature is seeing this as a primordial instinct of human individuals, even more primordial than sexuality. And that's just a much more modest concept. It's about psychological drive. You can trace similar variants with the concept of the eternal return, and I think to a lesser extent to the Übermensch, which is not a very highly developed concept in Nietzsche's work. So, we have a poetic philosopher, a non-systematic philosopher, a nihilistic critic of the dominant ideology of the West of the last 2,500 years, give or take, which sees value placed in the higher world, in the imaginary higher world, thereby resulting in a denigration, a calumny of this world, of our world of lived experience. And Nietzsche wants to revalue that value system. In fact, Nietzsche's projected last work was called the Revaluation of All Values. This was his great task, the revaluation of all values. So looking at existing values and weighing them testing them and looking for alternatives where they're found wanting. But how do you test them? How do you weigh them? What's the touchstone? And the touchstone is this idea of affirmation, of life affirmation, which of course has its counterpart in life negation. Now, these are not stark opposites. This is not like a binarism, particularly. They actually involve each other. For instance, extreme life negation is a project which Nietzsche thought this was the project of the ascetic priests, or the project of asceticism, was actually to annihilate oneself so that the higher would shine through. Of course, ego and the embodiment that it's enmeshed with is of course the fallen Christianity, or the lower world for Plato. Yet in that scenario, it requires an immense amount of will to attempt to negate the will. And in that way, very powerfully attempted life negation as a project in the name of the higher world, or of God, if you like, becomes affirmation. Because you end up having to affirm will. Because it's only through will that you can do it. And will, of course, is this quintessential part, self-will, of the human individual. So Nietzsche points out, yeah, even the no's, the most strident no's of the ascetic priest, become tender yeses. Simply because life can't upend itself. And the project of negating life in oneself actually ends up refining life energy and will to power in the individual that undertakes it. And in that way, affirmation returns. And similarly, affirmation is always tempted by negation. Because if you are truly going to affirm life, you can't wear any rose-coloured spectacles when you encounter it. For the affirmation of life to be authentic, you have to encounter life as it is, without wish fulfillment. And you will encounter, given just how hard life is, you'll encounter the desire to escape. You'll encounter the strong force inside us that weaves compensatory fantasies, that makes everything hunky-dory when it's not. So the affirmation contains the temptation of negation. Negation, life negation, contains the seeds of life affirmation. And when you use the binary to weigh things like that, you need to bear that in mind. It's not a simple appraisal, like measuring or weighing on a scale. It's not a quantification. It doesn't fall into the schemas of mathematized logic. Which is why, of course, Nietzsche isn't Russell's technical philosopher. In fact, it ends up being a kind of a storytelling, a poeticizing, a reflection on real lived experiences of real people, including oneself, if one's going to be in this game. Nietzsche did see a lot of this cultural work happening on the terrain of the individual. So, the great task, the revaluation of all values, with a view to replacing negative, life-negating values with life-affirming values. And I think you see this played out quite a long time ago in the the in India, the tantric reaction to life negating orthodoxy. And Tantra turning that on its head with an affirmation of sexuality, an affirmation of ordinary life, an affirmation of all phenomena and of human life in general. You see that same thing played out. And I think that's what induced a Tibetan Lama who was asked about Nietzsche. He was a Lama who lived in Switzerland, I think, and who spoke German. I don't know the guy's name. But he said, having read Nietzsche, he said, this guy would be a tantric master if he had a little more tenderness. And Nietzsche did pride himself on his lack of pity. And he had rude things to say about compassion and so forth. So maybe the Tibetan master, the Tibetan Lama is right about that. But there are some passages in Nietzsche where he gives himself away, where the soft heart does display itself, just in one or two places. But I think that's for another occasion. Anyway, Nietzsche 101. It's something that nobody in their right mind would take on. That's the conclusion. Anyway, I hope you enjoy anyway. Over and out.